Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, riddle me this. When are falling prices bad? How about when they keep on falling? That's when. A macroeconomic vocabulary lesson today. Also, learning to love our office cubicles almost despite ourselves, and the fight to save Yahoo. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 6th of January. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. The word of the day today, as you might have guessed, is deflation. A general definition might go a little something like this: a consistent and real decrease in the price of pretty much everything over time. It is tempting to believe deflation is a good thing. Who doesn't like cheaper stuff? Am I right? But if you see prices going down, you, the American consumer, what's going to happen? You're not going to buy that new TV or dining room table, are you? No, you're not. You're going to wait and not buy. And if all your fellow consumers do the same thing, well, you see what happens to what economists call aggregate demand, don't you? It disappears. And so, too, very, very quickly does economic growth. Today's Deflation Primer is brought to you by the world's seven biggest economies, the G7 in the vernacular, where for the first time since the Great Depression, inflation, that is price increases, in all seven countries are expected to be below 2% this year, which is extraordinarily low, hence fears of deflation. Also low, and a place to look if you want to understand more about what is happening deflation-wise, were the yields in the bond markets today. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which we talk about almost every single day on this program, fell below 2%. Germany and Japan are down under a half of 1%, which means almost 6 years on since the financial crisis, money is still basically free. Marketplace's Dan Alcorn has more on what that means.
Larry Summers used to be the Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, meaning he was responsible for issuing and managing government debt. And even he has been caught off guard by the bond market this week.
I never would have expected to see a 10-year Treasury below 2% during my career.
He got used to low yields during the financial crisis of 2008.
But now, in the context of a recovery, it's even that much more surprising.
Surprising because investors often buy bonds for safety. They flock there and bid down yields, as they are today, when investing in the economy is frightening, like in the financial crisis. But the U.S. economy doesn't seem that frightening today. Stephen Major is the head of fixed income research at HSBC.
The most recent quarter, nominal GDP growth in the U.S. was above 5%. Five.
But a bond isn't about this quarter. It's about the next 10 years.
The bond yield is telling you that nobody believes that there'll be 5% growth over the next 10 years.
Over at Citigroup, Steve Englander agrees. Low bond yields hint at something deeper.
Yeah, I think there's this consistent sense that disaster is around the corner, and it's putting a lid on where bond yields can go.
The result, according to Larry Summers, is that people are saving instead of spending, and companies are doing the same. They're not building new factories, and they're not hiring.
It's a market judgment that this is not going to be anything like a normal recovery.
It's not a reason to panic, but he says it is a cause for concern. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
To be clear, by the way, we are not having deflation here. What we've got is what the experts like to call disinflation. Makes you love economics even more, doesn't it? The big news in television this week comes courtesy of cable, specifically ESPN. For years, there has been a small but growing number of cord cutters, people getting rid of cable in favor of streaming services like Netflix and Hulu. But there was always one thing holding a lot of those people back, a lot of those would-be people, I guess you'd say, live sports. To get live sports, you generally needed good old-fashioned cable bundles, the ones that can easily cost you $100 a month or more. Now, though, ESPN has decided to make itself available over the internet as part of a new streaming service from Dish Network. Dan Bobkoff explains why.
Because there's a group out there that gives media executives nightmares.
What in industry parlance they call the cord nevers.
Cord nevers. They are young, tech-savvy millennials. An analyst, Craig Moffat of Moffat Nathanson, says they never paid for cable TV in the first place and appear to have no interest in starting.
Most of the media companies thought those millennials were going to come streaming back to the pay TV model as soon as they either got married or had children. They're starting to question that premise.
So ESPN decided that if it's going to reach these cord nevers, it has no choice but to meet them where they are, online. For the first time, ESPN will be available as part of an internet-only streaming package called Sling TV. For $20 a month, you can get a couple of ESPN channels, plus a few others like TNT and CNN. Chris Young is an analyst with SNL Kagan. He estimates Dish is paying about $13 for the bundle of channels.
The potential will be a win-win for Dish, for ESPN, and consumers, with the key being if these are new customers.
That's what ESPN and Dish are betting on, that most of the people who sign up would never have paid for ESPN through traditional cable anyway. But Moffitt says the fear is that existing customers will switch to save money.
There's a big risk of cannibalization here.
ESPN is well aware of that, and its contract with Dish limits how fast Sling can grow. Even as the industry changes fast, no one wants to destroy the existing business model before they have to. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Yeah, no. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the holidays pretty much over, y'all are probably settled back in at the office, restarting the daily grind and all that. It might be good to be back. It might not be. But either way, that life we have at the office in those cubicles is a huge chunk of our lives. And it is also the subject of a piece in the current issue of New York Magazine. It's called To the Office with Love. It's by Jennifer Senior. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It does seem that we should do a little disclosure here. This is a piece about the problems that are often associated with modern office-like life, but you yourself enjoy working in an office.
Yeah. I was actually pushing against the, you know, kind of free agent nation fetishism. I wanted to celebrate the office here.
What is it, though, that we... I mean, we all hate cubicles, right? I mean, everybody hates cubicles. As much as we enjoy working in offices, and I do, I should raise my hand and say I enjoy the office environment. That whole thing about cubicles is just somehow it's become really bad.
They are the ultimate signifier for depersonalization. It's true. They're sort of the office pig, no matter how much lipstick you try to apply. What I would say, though, in defense of the sad gray cubicle, is that there's still your nest in a larger home. And if the cubicle goes away, what it means by implication is that you're not going to the office, right? You're at home. And then you have to ask what that means psychologically. If you're suddenly untethered, there's something about it that signifies permanence to people, that you go to the office and it means that you are an IBMer or a Googler. You know, that's what you are. And if you're a consultant and if you're not getting a lot of work, do you still feel like you're a graphic designer if no one's calling you? Yeah. Do you still feel like you are what you are if you're not being asked to do what you do best? And if you have an office to go to, there's much less ambiguity about that question.
Which I totally get and I buy into. Why then do we in this society, and we have for so long, romanticized this idea of striking out on our own, of going that freelance route, of going that creative self-employment thing? I mean, the numbers are, you know, some 40, 50% of us say we want to be self-employed and really only 10% of us are. Why do we have that itch?
Right. Well, to some degree, our nation was predicated on this notion of self-invention and striking out on your own. So in some ways, it's just baked into our DNA. That's part of it, I suppose. But I'm just going to point out that there is this other vision of office life, which is kind of romantic. If you look at 30 Rock, it's kind of an office comedy, right? It's like the best workplace, platonic workplace romance ever between Liz Lemon and Jack Donaghy. Mad Men, which, you know, has its own perversities, is actually a strikingly lovely depiction of the office in its way. Those people are each other's families. And that relationship that, like, Don Draper and Peggy has is kind of incomparable in its in its fashion. But I think that we kind of romanticize both.
There's a class element, I guess, in this, right? The freelancer occupations of, you know, graphic designer and, I don't know, landscape architect. I mean, those are generally white-collar, sort of upper-class kind of things. And then you have the contingent workers, right, who are not usually as
as privileged, I guess we should say.
And they're the ones that I think we should be the most worried about. What I thought was interesting looking at New York City-specific mm-hmm. data is that the white-collar professions here who are freelance often make more than those who are actually salaried. So if you're a freelance artist, you might do better than somebody who's, you know, on someone's payroll to do graphic design for them. If you're a food prep worker, you do worse if you're unaffiliated. So there's something especially punishing about the gig economy if you have less education and low skills. And they just do far worse in this economy. And we have nothing by way of infrastructure to help.
Jennifer Senior is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. She's also an author. Her book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. It comes out in paperback in a couple of weeks. Jennifer, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The hours are long, but the paychecks can be large when an oil and gas boom hits. That holds true out in Wyoming or North Dakota or pretty much any big energy state. But equally true is that housing in boom towns is always an issue, one that pits the needs of energy workers against the interests of the long-term residents of a given town. Because, as Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan reports, everybody knows an oil boom doesn't last forever.
When Richard Kale retired to the northwestern Wyoming town of Pinedale in the late 1990s, it was a sleepy place, mostly getting by on jobs in tourism and government. Kale bought some apartments and a hotel in Big Piney, about 30 miles south of Pinedale. He did steady business, nothing special. That is, until around 2005, when he started to get a lot more calls.
They'd be willing to pay, you know, two and three times what we were charging.
By the mid-2000s, a new technology called hydraulic fracturing had opened up thousands of natural gas wells around Pinedale. Hundreds of energy workers descended on the area, all looking for a place to stay.
There were continually calls, and yeah, they were willing to pay just about anything you'd ask them for it. There was a real frenzy for finding places.
The area just could not handle the demand.
At the end of the day, we just couldn't pull it together here.
Steve Smith was the mayor of Pinedale back then. The town scrambled to react to the boom, but there was never nearly enough housing to meet demand. What got in the way? Smith says, first, the free market.
Everything was going up very quickly in Pinedale. Folks that had lived here for a long time were seeing houses that might have been valued, you know, $100,000 to $150,000 now selling for $300,000. And in that market, in that real estate market, it's very difficult to find land to put in attainable housing.
Attainable housing. That's the term used for places that aren't necessarily cheap, but are available. The other big question was, do you invest in housing to encourage workers to stay, to become part of the community? For Mayor Smith, the answer was yes.
I wanted those people coming into our community to be part of our community, to pay sales tax and property tax, enroll their kids in school, let their spouse volunteer at the medical clinic or the retirement center. I thought that was important, and I still do.
Smith says locals welcomed the idea of their bars and diners filling up with energy workers. But when it came to housing, he was overruled. The town ultimately decided to restrict new housing in order to protect real estate values for long-term residents when the boom inevitably went bust. Fast forward 4 years, and the same scenario is playing out again, this time in the northeast Wyoming town of Wright.
You always want to have a waiting list. You always want to not have enough housing.
Roger Jones has developed apartments and townhouses in energy towns in Wyoming and the Dakotas. Right now, he's building some apartments in Wright, which is currently seeing a surge in oil development. But because these construction projects take an average of 1 to 2 years, contractors often underbuild because they don't know how long the boom will last. This time last year, crude oil was selling for over $100 a barrel. Now it's around half that.
3-4 months ago, I would have thought, gee, we're pushing on. All of the indicators are there. And then the oil prices go down, and now we're concerned.
Unlike the boom in Pinedale, the sheer size of which caught everybody off guard, Wright has had plenty of lead time to track the growth of oil and gas work. Mayor Tim Albin says he wants to see the energy workers in the area living and shopping in Wright. But he says the town has to invest long-term first. That's meant using oil tax proceeds to build an almost $10 million recreation center, but taking it slow with housing.
We want to build for the future and have our town be a permanent structure. We're not trying to just build stuff to handle the overflow and then go, we don't care what happens 2 years from now, if it folds or not.
When small towns and energy states are hit with the boom, they know a bust is probably coming too. Even with plenty of foresight, it's hard to get around the fact that investment in the needs of energy workers might not be a good investment for the town. Pinedale innkeeper Richard Kale might have said it best.
I mean, this happens every place. Nobody's prepared. Those things just happen and they adjust and it's a bitch.
In Wyoming, I'm Miles Bryant for Marketplace.
Coming up.
What's interesting about Marissa Meyer is that she is just full of contradictions.
Just like the company she runs, a little firm you might have heard of called Yahoo. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off another 130 points today, about 0.75%, 17,371 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ fell 59 points, more than 1.25%, 45.92. The S&P 500 gave back 17 points, almost 0.9%. Ended things at 2,002. Financials felt the pinch today. J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley all down at least 2%. Oil down again as well, by the by, more than 4%. The U.S. benchmark remains under $50 a barrel, $47.93 a pop. All that money has got to go somewhere if it's coming out of stocks, and it is going into bonds, as we explained up at the top of the broadcast. Bond prices shot up, and thus the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.94%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department lets us know what the trade deficit was in November. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee holds a hearing on the Keystone XL pipeline project. And on January 7th, 1963, the cost of a first-class stamp went up from 4 to 5 cents. An additional penny for your thoughts. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. What do you get when you cross a handbag and accessories business with a footwear company? I'm sure there is a snappy comeback to that someplace, but we are a business show, so you get the corporate answer. Coach says it's going to buy the Stuart Weitzman brand, which is, in case fashion is not your thing, a maker of shoes in the $300 to $700 range. The half-billion-dollar deal announced today comes after Coach's stock slid more than 30% last year, which kind of explains the half-billion-dollar deal announced today. Tim Fitzsimmons has the story.
Coach occupies a level of the fashion marketplace known as accessible luxury. That's expensive, but not too expensive. Your average American could buy a Coach bag for $300, but they'd have to think about it first. Part of Coach's stock troubles, though, is because the luxury aspect of its brand became too accessible, says Dorothy Lackner. She's a specialty retail analyst with Topeka Capital Markets.
It's also the result of having created a monster in their outlet stores and flash site through which they were discounting a lot of product.
By lowering the prices, they not only reduced their revenues, but also picked away at the luxurious luster of their brand. Here's Milton Pedraza, CEO of the Luxury Institute.
The problem in luxury is that you don't know you've crossed over the line until you've crossed over the line.
So last year would be that whoops moment for Coach.
Retail in general is pretty zero sum.
That's Sucharita Mulparu, a retail analyst at Forrester Research. When different brands become more popular, she says, others suffer. And Coach's more fashionable nemeses are named Tory Burch, Kate Spade, and Michael Kors. By buying the popular brand Stuart Weitzman, Coach will create a new revenue stream and may also find savings in economies of scale, like buying more leather and fabric in bulk. And Milton Pedraza says there might be something else afoot. Coach may be planning to become a conglomerate, like the big three holding companies behind top luxury brands like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, and Montblanc.
And accumulate a portfolio of brands that will be hopefully more resilient than just having one brand alone.
Maybe that will fix things. I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
A lot of what you would see were you in Las Vegas for their Consumer Electronics Show this week would be of or related to what has come to be called the smart home. There are more gizmos than ever this year that aim to take objects around the house and get them online. From Las Vegas, Nova Sappho has more.
Listen to some of the people hawking smart home technologies at CES, and you'd think we're all kind of paranoid.
We have a room motion sensor that will sit up in the corner. It's infrared, so it detects heat signatures.
To differentiate between pets and potential intruders. And that, by the way, is Leah Polk with the computer accessories company Belkin. She says you can even add sensors to people.
We also have a keychain sensor, which is designed to sit on your keychain or in your kid's backpack or on your pet's collar. That can tell you if they've come or gone.
Once you've put sensors throughout your home and on your family, Alarm.com wants to be the Apple of this sensorized world. Jay Kenney says his company can be the platform to make everything work together.
So when the
security system is disarmed. The lights can turn on, the thermostat can adjust, the garage door can close. All these things happen automatically as they're, you know, as if they're all one sort of organism.
Now, this sounds a little far off to me, but the tech companies here at CES insist it's in the near future. Sean Dubrovac is a senior economist with the Consumer Electronics Association.
We're at an inflection point where these emerging categories are defining what the growth profile looks like in the years to come.
Dubrovac says whether that's 2 years or 10 depends on how easy the latest gadgets are for the average consumer to adopt. At the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, I'm Nova Safa for Marketplace.
Yahoo is a company we talk about on this program from time to time, but not always in a good way. Yahoo's been up and down a whole lot in the 20 years since it was founded, down mostly the past couple of years. Marissa Mayer took over as CEO back in the summer of 2012. To great acclaim, it has to be said, but it also has to be said that the jury is really still out. Mayer and the company she runs are the subjects of a new book by Nicholas Carlson from Business Insider. It is called Marissa Mayer and the Fight to Save Yahoo. Nicholas, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
It does seem that one of the long-running tropes in Silicon Valley and the tech industry in this country the last, I don't know, like 10, 12 years has been the fight to save Yahoo, right?
That's right. It's been a fight almost since the beginning.
And we have to remember that this, in the beginning, was the company that basically created the online ad business and had the whole smash right in its hands.
Yahoo, at one point, had a very specific purpose. It was a user-friendly way to use the internet. And then other companies started getting on the internet, creating websites that people could use. And Yahoo was just too many things. It was too many things on an internet where what really won was the eBays, the Googles, the Facebooks, which just did one thing really well. And Yahoo kind of just did everything. When they decided to hire Marissa Mayer, they decided to go with the product strategy for Yahoo.
She had, I mean, to be completely fair, she had a whiz-bang first year or so, right? She was hailed as the conquering hero.
They rolled out a purple carpet for her. And over the next...
Literally, right? The purple carpet?
They really did. Yeah. The co-founder of Yahoo, David Filo, rolled out a purple carpet for her. And she walked into her office and she got her computer ready to code. She got all these congratulatory calls from, you know, the White House and J.P. Morgan and just all sorts of celebrity. It was an amazing first year. And she got the place revitalized. She got it producing products much faster than it ever had in a long, long time. But then, you know, the honeymoon seemed to come to an end. You know, people think about Marissa Mayer as this person on the cover of Vogue or just perfectly coiffed. But what's interesting about Marissa Mayer and the reason why I ended up wanting to write this book is that she is just full of contradictions. She's not really that person in that picture. You know, when she signed her deal, her $200 million deal with Yahoo, she shows up to the law offices of one of the board members in a 10-year-old green BMW. Her hair's wet. She comes in and she signs it. She's all by herself. There's no handlers or anything like that. And she signs it and then she says, okay, I better go tell Google that I'm quitting. And so she goes. And the people there were like, well, do you want us to send people to, you know, do you want to take a car? Do you need some help, like, clearing out your office? She's like, oh, no, my mom's in town. She's going to help out. Uh-huh. So, you know, Marissa, yes, she is this glamorous person who, and the world wants to pay attention to her. But what's fascinating to me is beyond that, she's a very different person behind closed doors.
If she succeeds, she will have earned it. I think you'd agree with that, right?
That's right.
Right. Okay. But if she fails, right, if in 2 years the board comes to her and says, Marissa, thank you so much, but you got to go,
yep.
Is it her fault or is it because fundamentally Yahoo can't be saved?
So I think Marissa Mayer is doing the job she was hired to do. You know how Steve Jobs came into Apple and it took him 5 years?
Came
and
back,
he came
yeah.
up with, he came up with the iPod and it was like a Hail Mary and it was an amazing product and it totally sent Apple onto the track we see it today where it's the world's most valuable company and it's just incredible. That's what they hired Marissa Mayer to do. And by the way, that's a very hard job to do.
Yeah.
And so she has done lots of things to get the company pointed in that direction. But at some point, you just need to come up with the iPod. And that's not...
Oh, is that all?
That's all. No, exactly. So it's an extremely monumental task to ask someone to do. And you know, listen, in talking to people who work inside of Yahoo, what I came across time and time again is that Marissa Meyer is a good product person. She really understands what people want and how to use it. But that doesn't always make the difference. Over the history of the internet, what we've seen is that startups tend to be the companies that come up with the next big thing that people want to use, not established companies.
It is a book called Marissa Meyer and the Fight to Save Yahoo by Nicholas Carlson. It is, I will tell you, a fascinating read. Nicholas Carlson, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which actually might be this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us, or at least the apocalypse as CNN intends to broadcast it. From the website Jalopnik, this item: back when CNN went on the air 34 years ago, Ted Turner, the founder of CNN, said this, quote, "Barring satellite problems, we won't be signing off until the world ends," end quote. Apparently, there is an actual video file in CNN's video vault called Hold for Release Until the End of the World. It's a band playing Nearer My God to Thee, and then the screen goes black. Honest. You should see it. We've got a link to the story at marketplace.org. And with that, we are out of here. Not the end of the world, I promise. The Dow off 130 points today. The NASDAQ down 59 points. The S&P 500 off 18 points. Caitlin Ash, Millie Jefferson, and Lindsay Thomas are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will be back here again tomorrow, no matter what CNN says. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.